realize what's happened. And then you confess our partners. Never need to talk about the story.
Well, you just lose it, though.
Go on, please.
Then we talk about restoring, which means what's happened through this genocide is that the resources of North America have been very badly skewed against the original inhabitants. We took their land. We took their resources. How do we get the resources rebalanced so that we don't have the natives living on the worst land with the least resources and thus their lives having no base to work from? How do we do that? And then, first thing is we need to do it, not simply by doing it for them, but by talking with them, saying, oh, what's going on here? What do you need? How can we change this? Because otherwise it's very paternalistic. We just say, we'll fix it for them, you know? And then, we're trying to, how do we restore what's stolen when we can't just all move away and give them all back the land as it was? We can't recreate 500 million bison on the Western Plains. And finally, a map, and that is, there are still psychopaths out there still doing genocide. How do we recognize what's going on and not continue? So those are our steps. Now, looking back, going into this question, what's the problem? Native American tribes and other indigenous people have been devastated by European colonization with religious justification. We thought it was God wanted us to do this, or at least that's what our psychopaths said. Recognize the psychopaths will use religious language, but they don't know what they're talking about. They'll talk about God, and they'll use that as justification, but it doesn't make sense when you really get into it. Religious values were involved, naively by many of us, and insincerely by psychopaths. The real driving values were greed and wealth and empire. And even good people who tried to resist the oppression were hindered by unconscious biases. We're talking here about the missioners, who, like Bartolomé de las Casas, who did good things, but still ended up Europeanizing the natives in a way that violated their own cultures. Well, we start out with 1435, Eugene IV, with a document. What was going on was that Portugal and Spain, or Castile, there was no Spain yet, had discovered the Canary Islands. They realized they were there, and they were starting to evangelize the people of the Canary Islands. But, of course, because of the empire getting involved in this, Portugal wanted to run it, and Spain wanted to run it, and they would run into attack each other. Meanwhile, pirates would arrive and seize people and enslave them. So this book came out and said, now, wait a minute, you can't enslave Christians. So I should say people who aren't Christians. You're not allowed to enslave Christians. And what the Portuguese went, and they were just beginning to convert these people, and then some Spanish came in and enslaved them, and the people said, oh, is this what you mean by Christianity, slavery? I guess we don't want it. And so the Pope didn't like that. He said, we want to help people be Christian. We don't want them to run away because they can see that we're trying to enslave them. So that was the first 1435 that said, if you've enslaved them, you have to restore them to their liberty. All right? Now realize, this is 1492, was Columbus. So this was before anyone knew there was in North America. We're talking here about people who are either natives of the islands off the west of Africa or who are Muslim. And of course, the idea was it's all right to enslave Muslims. We're into, of course, this problem. That's where the Canary Islands are, down here. Let me see, I jump over a couple things here. No. All right, so next thing, 1452, what's happening is the Muslims are starting to invade Europe. Well, here's what is going on. All the areas in color here are Muslim. Everything. All this. Islam. And it's attacking Constantinople. And it's attacking, actually, it gets in as far as Venice before it stops. And up through Spain. And so the Europeans, the Christians, and the Pope are very much worried about this. So they're trying to stop it. And so we get this 1452 saying, okay, we give you Kings of Spain and Portugal the rights to go around, invade, search out, capture, subjugate the Saracens, the Muslims. See, this was thought at that time to be a good thing. Now notice that we're in the midst of the feudal period, where everybody has a boss. You know, I mean, there's a few rulers up the top, and then there's these big landowners and everybody, practically everybody's a serf. So everyone takes for granted that they have to be under somebody. Now the question is, who's they're going to be under? And so what we're talking about here is the Pope saying to these leaders, well, I'll have to be under you, not under those Muslims. So by your apostolic authority, you can search out, capture, subjugate, and their kingdoms and principalities, and reduce them to perpetual servitude, make them slaves. And that's, as I said, where it's going on. That's why they're worried. Now, 1493, notice this is 1 year after Columbus. And, I should say something else about this earlier one. It is 1 year after he made this agreement, Constantinople fell to the Muslims. So he was really dealing with what he considered to be a real problem. Now, 1 year after Columbus...
Can you go back to that map, please?
Yeah, back to the
map. Talk a little bit about that map.
You have a question about it?
So can you explain them a little bit, please?
Well, the colors are the various stages of the growth of Islam.
Okay.
So you start out in Arabia, and then it goes to the purple, and then it goes to the greenish stuff. And all at this time, all of Spain is Muslim. But it's beginning to be what's called the Reconquista, the reconquest. They're starting to push the Muslims up. And actually, in 1492 was the conclusion of the reconquest. And we talk about sending Columbus off to the New World. In the same year, Ferdinand and Isabella sent all the Jews out of Spain. He drove them out. And he would have done the same with the Muslims, but he figured we can convert them. So they tried to convert the Muslims for a while, then that didn't work, and then they threw the Muslims out. But 1492, and also then, Constantinople had been captured by this time. So that's why it was named to Istanbul. Istan means Islam, Bul means city. So it's Islam city. Okay? So you can understand why the Europeans are nervous about all these Muslims. Okay. So 1 year after Columbus' first voyage, he realizes there's a whole other group of countries here. And what do we do about that? Well, he says, well, we're very glad about the Catholic faith and Christian religion. We want you to bring it everywhere. And so we ask them, barbarous nations be overthrown and brought to the faith. Barbarous nations. So now that you've succeeded in throwing the wars out of Grenada and you have time and energy for other tasks, we'd like you to go over to that new world. And we give grant and assign to you and your heirs and successors all rights and jurisdictions and appurtenances, all islands, all mainlands found and to be found, discovered and to be discovered, towards the west and south. And what he did was, what he was worried about was that Spain was going to go over and Portugal was going to go over, and they were both going to try to seize territories and they were going to fight each other. So he said, no, enough of that. What I'll do is I'll draw a line from the North Pole to the South Pole on one of these longitudes, and everything to the east will go to the Portuguese and everything to the west will go to the Spanish. Because he wasn't including England there, and France, or some of those others. So, what we want you to do is, you can seize any one of those territories that hasn't already been seized by any other European Christian country. In other words, if it's not a Christian country, it's fair game. But if some other Christian country has already seized it, you must go seize that one. He's trying to keep the Europeans from fighting each other. And you realize that at the time they weren't quite sure where these lands were. So this is a sort of contemporary map. They know that there's Africa over here, and they know there's some stuff over here, but they have no idea how far down or up it goes, or, you know. So that's why they say countries discovered or to be discovered. They're just not quite sure yet what this all amounts to. So now, what happened when you came to the country is you'd land on the shore, and you'd go ashore, and there'd be some people there, and they'd be curious about who you are, and so you'd read this thing to them, this Recurimento. On behalf of the king and the queen, subjugators of barbarous people, like you, we, your servants, notify and make known to you that God chose St. Peter to be the head of the entire human race. That's the code. And St. Peter gave to the king of Spain your land. You got it? So now we beseech and demand that you accept the church, recognize the Pope, acknowledge the king and queen as lords of these islands and mainlands by virtue of this donation that God gave to the Pope Peter and the Pope Peter gave to the king of Spain. If you don't do this, however, we'll enter your land against you with force, make war in every place, and by every means we can, and are able, we will make subject you to the yoke and authority of the church and their highnesses. We'll take you and your wives and children and make them slaves. We'll sell them, we'll dispose of you and them, and we'll take your property and do all the harm and evil we can, as is done to vassals who will not obey their lord. You see that sense of the feudalist society. If the vassals don't obey their lord, they're very bad vassals. And that's just not everybody is living under that kind of a system. And so why would it be different with you? All we're doing is changing your lord. That's all. I do not wish to assist him. We avow the deaths and the harm we shall receive will be your fault and not ours.
David, can we go back to that slide?
Yeah.
Just above your highlighted thing,
yes.
It says, and we'll do you all the harm and evil we can. So is the church saying that it's going to be doing evil to them? Or I mean, is it admitting that there is some kind of moral quandary here? Or why are they using the term evil?
Well, that's a good question. We'd have to go probably back and study what they were thinking when they wrote this. Remember that this wasn't necessarily written by, quote, the church. This is a form that the conquistadores would read.
Oh, using, okay.
All right. Okay. This one is not does not have a pope signing it. And so there's this little picture, sort of what we come up. All right. Now, some of the missionaries didn't like this idea. Bartolomé Las Casas is a very interesting guy. He was a personal friend of Columbus. I think he was on the second voyage, and he was one of the conquistadores, not armed especially, but he inherited some of this property in the West Indies and ruled it for a while. And then he realized this wasn't a good idea. He had a conversion and became, I think, a Franciscan and eventually a bishop. He became the bishop of Chiapas in Mexico. You might realize Chiapas has been in a revolt against the state of Mexico recently. But so he started to resist what was going on. And here's what he said here's what he said in description of how the conquistadores operated. The Spaniards no sooner perceived it. They mounted ungenerous steeds, well-weaponed, began exercises of bloody butcheries, spared no age or sex, not so much as women with child, ripping open their bellies, tore them alive in pieces, led wagers who could cut or divide a man in two with one blow with the sword. I can do it. No, I can do it. Which of them should they decollate, knock off the head? You notice that's something we worry about today. With the greatest dexterity, who should sheath his sword in the bowels of man with the quickest dispatch? Snatch young babies, dash their heads against the rocks, throw them into rivers. They erect gibbets and they erect a gibbet for 13 people. They say, we're doing this in honor of Jesus and his 12 apostles. And they hang 13 people on to build a fire and you can roast them. Now, when they would cut their heads almost all the way off, so they were just hanging by the skin, and then they'd send them into the forest to say, go tell your friends this is what will happen to them if they don't bring us the gold we told them to. or then put them on gridirons, and this is what they did with the leaders. They put them on gridirons and roast them. And they were, if they gave loud shrieks and shouts, then the captain said, I don't like that noise, go strangle them. But the executioner said, no, I don't want to do that, so he put gags in their mouths until they were properly roasted. So this is Bartolome writing to the king of Spain, saying this is not a good idea that we allow this to happen. And the king is disturbed by it. Meanwhile, there's another group of Dominicans led by Antonio Montesino, who we're saying here is that there was resistance in the church, you see. And he stood up at Easter time and he made this sermon. I'm the voice of one crying in the wilderness. I am the voice of Christ crying in the wilderness of this island. This voice declares that you are all in mortal sin and live and die therein by reason of the cruelty and tyranny you practice on this innocent people. This is the kind of sermon you're used to hearing, probably. By what right or justice do you hold these Indians in such cruel and horrible slavery? By what right do you wage such detestable wars on these people who lived mildly and peaceably in their own lands, where you've consumed infinite number of them with unheard of murders and desolations? Now realize he's talking about the Indians of the Caribbean, who were very much peaceful type Indians. Now, this wouldn't have applied quite the same way to the Aztecs, who would kill a captive each morning to keep the sun rising. Or, so that not all natives were always peaceful. There was a variety of possibilities. But anyway, in this case, why do you so greatly oppress? So they die, or rather are slain by you, so that you may extract and acquire gold. Now, what care do you take that they receive religious instruction and come to know their God and Creator? Or that they be baptized, hear mass? Are they not mad humans? Do they not have rational souls? Are you not bound to love them as you love yourself? How can you lie in such profound and lethargic slumber? Be sure that in your present state you can be no more safe than the Moors or Turks, the Muslims, who do not have and do not want the faith of Jesus Christ. So this is Montesinos. It turns out the conquistadors did not appreciate hearing the sermon. And so they complained to the king, who complained to the Dominican superiors in Spain, who told the preachers not to disturb the people like this, and recalled them to Spain. But the king is still disturbed by the report, so he asks Francisco de Vitoria to study the matter. Now, Francisco goes through the reasons given why it's all right for the Spanish to go through this, like the Pope gave it to us, and these people aren't really human. They're just animals. And he went through all that, and he said, no, that's not true. These are human beings, and they do have the capacity to own things. They are reasonable, and they have a certain ownership and leadership. And so that's not a reason to seize the land. Furthermore, the Pope has no authority or power to give their land away. So that's not a reason to seize the land. However, there might be one reason, and that is humanitarian. If these people are cannibals, or if they are doing human sacrifice, then maybe you should move in and take over so as because you have humanitarian care for the poor people who are being slaughtered. Well, that wasn't good enough for the king. The king was still displeased, and so then he added another. He said, well, maybe you see, here's the thing. These Indian cultures really is inferior, and they should allow the Spaniards to come in and civilize them. Furthermore, anybody in the world should be free to go anywhere in the world, as long as they don't cause harm. So if the Spaniards want to come in to South America, as long as they're not causing harm, you shouldn't let them in. But if the locals won't let them in, then that's a reason for them to force their way in, you see, because their human right is being violated, and so they can force their way in. Because they have such tender hearts, they weren't intending to hurt anybody, as long as they got their gold. Well, but you can see these things didn't solve the problem. The king started to put on pressure to act more humanely, but the locals just ignored him. Meanwhile, in 1537, Pope Paul III came out with a document which is often quoted now as to say, well, the church, these don't count anymore because the church reversed it all in 1537. Indians and all other peoples are by no means to be deprived of their liberty or the possession of their property, even though they be outside the faith of Jesus Christ. Even if they be pagans, even if they be Muslims, they may should freely and legitimately enjoy their liberty and the possession of their property, not be enslaved. And if this contrary happens, it's null, doesn't count. And these people should be converted to the faith of Christ by preaching and by example, not by force. All right? Well, that's nice, but people didn't pay attention. Meanwhile, the Europeans up north, the ones from England, were saying, look at those terrible Spanish, what they're doing to the natives. They're not kind and generous like we are. So here's an example of the Puritans fighting the Pequot Indians. And notice the religious tenor of these comments. And it did such a dreadful terror, did the Almighty let fall upon these spirits? Did God, the Almighty, let fall upon these spirits? They'd run away from us and run into the very flames of the buildings that we set on fire. And so they were at their wits' end, who not many hours before had been exalting themselves, threatening the utter ruin and destruction of the English with their dances and songs. And war dances. But God was above them, with who left his enemies and the enemies of his people to scorn, making them a fiery oven. There were the stout-hearted spoiled, having slept their last sleep, and none of their men could find their hands. Thus did the Lord judge among the heathen, filling the place with dead bodies. Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, blessed be his holy name. He was pleased to smite our enemies in the hinder parts and give us their land for an inheritance. Recognize the words there? Give us their land for an inheritance. We're talking now about new holy land, the holy people coming into the new holy land. Who remembered us in our lowest day. Let us therefore praise the Lord for his goodness and his wonderful works to the children of man who helped us to slaughter these natives. This has to be a psychopath, don't you think?
Yeah.
Well, now, then we saw that the U.S. Supreme Court picked this up. The U.S. Supreme Court trying to figure out who controls the land, and the Cherokee had come and when shortly would come and brought a suit to the Supreme Court saying, well, look, it's our land. You can't kick us off. And the Supreme Court said, well, actually, you know, it's not your land because, you see, there's this doctrine that the first really civilized people to discover the land are the owners. The really civilized means Christians. It means European settlers. And this whole land was given to England, you know, in this, between Spain, Portugal, and so on. And this was all for England. And when the U.S. became independent, the U.S. inherited England's donation of the land. And so the land you've been living on for centuries really belongs to the English. So I'm sorry, but you may be calling yourself a nation, but you're really not a nation. You're sort of a dependent nation. You're not an independent state. You're a domestic, dependent nation. We let you live here, but we're running it. You're related to the U.S. government as a ward is related to its guardian. This is the United States Supreme Court. Following year, and this was the second one, the Cherokee versus Georgia, was because, you see, the Cherokee had adopted many of the Western styles. They were farming in the European style. They were wearing Western style clothing. They had developed a written form of their language. They were printing their own newspaper. Unfortunately, gold was discovered on their territory in Georgia. And so Georgia decided that they really would be happier in Oklahoma. And so it decided to send them there. And they appealed to the Supreme Court. And this is when the Supreme Court said, no, you're just like a domestic nation. Well, the following year, the Supreme Court had another case on the same from the Cherokee again, and it changed its mind. And said, actually, we do think that you are sovereign, and therefore Georgia has no right to force its laws in your territory. Furthermore, the Indian Removal Act, which has said it will remove you to Oklahoma, is illegal. and unconstitutional and invalid and against the treaties of the U.S. This was the U.S. Supreme Court. So the governor of Georgia said, well, the U.S. Supreme Court has passed this law, now let it enforce it. And they sent in their army, and they took the Cherokee to Oklahoma. President Andrew Jackson said, well, this is about our state's rights. The federal government cannot interfere with the rights of the state of Georgia. And so 17,000 Cherokee were moved to Oklahoma, and what became known as the Trail of Tears, about 4,000 of them dying on the journey. So a picture of the Trail of Tears. Anyway, we begin to see some of these problems. Now, we did know that the Christian missionaries would mitigate the worst effects of this. Bartolomé de las Casas reported the settlers' crimes to the king, helped them to form native cooperative villages. Now, what the Spaniards were doing was they were forming these encomiendas. It was basically a European-style landowner and his serfs, only the landowners was the European, and the serfs were the natives. And they were calling these things encomiendas. And some of the Christians, like de las Casas, were forming counter-encomiendas in a Christian form. They were treating their servants more kindly. Treating them more kindly. But it was still very patriarchal. So they were still sort of pushing the natives into European-style culture and treating them like children and, well, spanking them if they got out of hand and things like that, you know, beating them up. So it wasn't exactly perfect, but it was an improvement. And they expressed native culture. So here's an example of a picture of one of the Christian was. What would happen then is that the conquistadores would complain about these Christian encomiendas, that they were upsetting the Indians and making them think there was something wrong with their own encomiendas, you know. Why do these Christians come in and spoil everything by treating these natives in this unrealistically kind way? And Junipero Serra did something similar along the coast of California. The Anglican Bishop Benjamin Whipple, you remember, interceded with Lincoln to review the death sentences after the Dakota Uprising here in Minnesota, and from several hundred who were supposed to be executed, he reduced it to, what was it, 49? 38. It was going to be 39, and then one was found innocent, so we hung 38 of them at one time in New Orleans, which still remains the largest public hanging in U.S. history. But it was reduced because of Benjamin Whipple. On the other hand, Whipple did approve of the Minnesotans seizing the Dakota lands because he said, if we seize their lands, they have less land, they're going to be forced to farm the land rather than just range, you know, shooting the wild animals they find. And this will improve their life because they'll learn how to farm the land. They'll become civilized like us. So you can see how, still unconsciously, there's this sense of our way is better than your way. Well, attitudes have begun to change. Second Vatican Council Declaration on Religious Freedom. Religious communities have the right not to be hindered in their public teaching, witness to their faith. We're thinking of things like Christians in China under communists. But also, in spreading religious faith and in introducing religious practices, everyone ought to refrain from any manner of action which might seem to carry a hint of coercion. Do you suppose that what the conquistadores did was carrying a hint of coercion? Like seizing children and smashing their brains on the rocks? Or a kind of persuasion dishonorable, unworthy, when dealing with poor or uneducated people? Like the natives, poor and uneducated. Well, you know, they might have been uneducated in certain European ways, but they knew a lot more about which plants would heal people than the settlers did. So they're not just uneducated. Such an act of action would be an abuse of one's right, a violation of the right of others. It's The major tenet of Catholic doctrine that man's response to God and faith must be free. No one is to be forced to embrace the Christian faith against his own will. Second Vatican Council is talking about non-Christian religions. Says that the Catholic Church rejects nothing that is true and holy in non-Christian religions. Now the trick is, what does that mean, true and holy? You know, we'll reject whatever is not true or not holy. But we won't reject what's true and holy. But it is a way of saying, let's take a look at this non-Christian religion and see what might be there that is true and holy. What might there be in the religion of the Native Americans and their lead religious leaders, their holy people, their shamans? What might be true about them? And pay attention to it. So, their ways of conduct, the precepts and teachings, differing in many aspects from the one she holds and sets forth, nevertheless often reflect a ray of that truth which enlightens all men. So we're still being paternalistic here. We're still saying, we've got the whole truth. You might have a ray of the truth. Let's talk about it and see where that ray might be. But at least it's an improvement over the past. Therefore, the Church exhorts her sons that through dialogue and collaboration with the followers of other religions carried out with prudence and love and in witness to the Christian faith, they recognize, preserve, and promote the good things, spiritual and moral, as well as the social cultural values found among these people. And that would include language, too. You know, we went to great effort to destroy the natives' language by sending all their children to schools run by missionaries where they were beaten if they used their own language. A church reproves as foreign to the mind of Christ any discrimination against men and women, or harassment of them because of their race, color, condition of life, or religion. So again, these two documents are Second Vatican Council, they are current position of the Roman Catholic Church. So, confession. Now, I talked to you about the first thing was realize there's a problem and admit it. Now, confess it. A Theological Commission in 1999, headed by Ratzinger, talks about the sad chapter of history when the sons and daughters of the Church acquiesce to intolerance and even the use of force in the service of truth. And he's thinking about, for example, the use of force in the Inquisition. You don't have the truth, so we'll kill you so that other people, seeing that they might get killed, will come back to the truth. And he's opposing that. This refers to forms of evangelization that employed improper means to announce the revealed truth, or did not include an evangelical discernment suited to the cultural values of people. You can talk about the good news, but talk about the good news in the culture of the Dakota, rather than in the culture of the goal. Or did not respect the conscience of the person to whom the faith was presented, as well as all forms of force used in the repression and correction of errors. Again, this is 1999. Now, Pope John Paul II was going around apologizing for all sorts of things the Church had done. He was making the Vatican very nervous. And some theologians, you know, they thought, oh, he's going to apologize for too much. But anyway, he went ahead and did it. However, his apologies were not always exactly complete. He would say, we apologize very much for the way in which the Church in the past may have perhaps violated certain rights of the natives. Instead of saying, look, the 1492 document, the 1903 document, is null and void. We made a mistake. It wasn't true. It's not what we believe. And that's what the natives are asking the Catholic Church to do. And I think they have a point. All right. Now we're going to restore. How are we going to restore? You know? We're going to tear this building down and replant, grasslands and bring in bison and give it back to the Dakota. Well, maybe we can't do all of that, but here's the point. There are resources in North America, in the United States. those resources currently are not fairly divided between different peoples and different groups. The Dakota, for example, and other Native tribes, do not have a fair share of the resources of North America. How can we rebalance the resources? It may not be giving them back a plane with Indian, with buck bison. It may be giving them fertile land, giving them good resources, giving them excellent education, helping them get excellent education, giving them homes, giving them infrastructure. We want to start to think about how that might be done, and I have a suggestion or two that might help. And one of my examples is, after the Second World War, we basically radically transformed the United States by the GI Bill of Rights. A lot of soldiers who would never have gone to college if there hadn't been a war. We came back from the war, and the leaders were worried that we were going to dump all these people back into the labor market and fall right back into the Depression of the 30s, because we didn't have enough jobs for them. So we've got to do something with them. What are we going to do? Let's send them to college. So we put a lot of money into sending these veterans to college, the GI Bill. Why couldn't we do that with Native Americans? Why couldn't the federal government pay the tuition and the living expenses? Because that's what we did. Tuition, books, living expenses of any Native American who would like to get college education. However, not necessarily college education according to Western standards. Couldn't we provide the resources so the natives could design their own form of college education, university education, further education? There are very well-educated Native Americans, and some of them are teaching at our own universities. Why couldn't we sort of start to put money into this? Would this make a difference? And then providing resources in addition afterward for them to get a start in, what kind of a life are they going to want to lead? And what kind of, and that's the question they ask, what kind of life do you want to lead? We don't want to say to them, well, obviously you want to ride horses out of the horse plains and kill bison, so that's what we'll give you. Maybe that's not what they want. You know, people are able to make their own choices. And here's the question, is some are suggesting maybe we should just leave the natives back to the life they lived a century ago. Well, maybe they don't want that. You know, maybe these two cultures having run into each other, maybe each of us sees something in the other culture we like. So some of us see a concern for the environment in the native culture, then we think, you know, we've been missing that. We should have that. And a fine example of natives adopting something from outside is this. When you think of Dakota, how do you usually imagine a Dakota? You know, a strong male Dakota. Isn't he running around the plains on a horse, chasing bison? Where did the horse come from? The horse was not native to North American Native Americans. The Spaniards brought the horses over, and the natives stole them and bred them in, and developed a horse culture, very strong horse culture, but it was a something that they received from this other culture and developed. And they did it on their own. We didn't say to them, hey, we think you need horses. They said, I think we want your horse, and they took it, and they developed it. Well, they did because we were taking all their stuff, why shouldn't they? So, GI Bill, Native American Bill of Rights, but let the natives do the education, and also encourage the natives in their organizing, you know, approve of their organization. The other big change in the white culture in the 30s and 40s was unions. So why are we always against a native movement? You know, we're afraid they're getting together, they're going to get strong. We should be encouraging them to get together and make their own plans. All right. Now, dialogue presumes that both sides have something to offer. Professor George Tinker, who is an example of a Native American who can teach in Western-style universities, he teaches in Colorado, and he's an Osage Indian. He points out that even with the best of intentions, those missionaries who were reducing the problems, who were trying to help the Native Americans, were still a part of the what he calls cultural genocide. In other words, forcing the natives to change their culture against their will, their language and everything else. So, and he gives examples. He has a book which studies four of them: John Elliott, Junipero Serra, Pio John de Smet, and Henry Benjamin Whipple. So two of those are Catholic and two are Protestant. And he shows how they, even with the best of intentions, they unconsciously distorted their preaching to fit European biases. And so, do Christians need to forego evangelization because it's culturally destructive? Should we not tell people about Jesus? Well, would natives prefer to be left alone to maintain their cultures without interference? Perhaps such a limitation would itself be paternalistic. Should the natives be allowed to decide what aspects of another culture they might want to adopt? They want to adopt horses? Okay. They want to adopt Jesus? Okay. We'll talk about it. Let's share it. But at the same time, let them share with us. What is there in their culture that we're missing? Are we treating animals and trees like dirt, or like things, with no spirit in them? Is there something wrong that we should do differently? And that's an example of the horses. Now, there's still, I think, there's still space for sharing the gospel, so long as we're open to receiving as well, and we respect the integrity of our dialogue partner. And realize the ways that our sharing is culturally narrow. And the word enculturation is a way of saying, if we're going to preach the gospel, we need to bring the gospel into the culture which is we're inviting to receive it. We need to understand the culture, and as it begins to enter the culture, we need to trust the local people under the influence of the Holy Spirit to know how to adapt, how to live this new vision, this new reality they haven't known before, in their own culture, within the terms of their own culture. An example of that is Black Elk. Some of you know about the book Black Elk Speaks. And you may know that Neihardt wrote only half of Black Elk's life, actually less than half. He wanted a book that described the sort of ending of the Native religious culture. He sort of presented Black Elk as an example of one of the last of the Dakota holy men, who at the end of the book is sitting sadly on one of the mountains in the Black Hills, looking out over the plain, mourning the loss of the religious riches of his community. But he failed to mention, even when Black Elk urged him to mention, that Black Elk spent the last almost half century of his life as a Roman Catholic catechist, going from one reservation to another, encouraging Dakota to embrace the Catholic faith. But embrace the Catholic faith as understood from a kind of Dakota base. What he did was, here's the problem, scholars now dispute whether Black Elk was really converted or whether he was just pretending to be converted in order to live a more comfortable life. And you get some people on each side of that. But the best answer I've heard is most likely, but this could take more study, is that he was really truly converted, but he was converted not to the Western form of Christianity, but to the radical core of Christianity, which he then used to criticize the Western form that was being imposed. So it's kind of like the blacks in the South, the black slaves, picking up Christianity, but they were reading books that their masters didn't especially want them to read, like books about Philemon, you know, please release your slave, and books about freedom and those sorts of things. And they wrote the black spirituals as a way of expressing within their own reality, the Christian reality, which was confronting what the slave owners were trying to impose on them. So something along those lines, Black Elk. I can't. You should come. But he was confronted, Hunter, with the Christians were doing to the Dakota on the basis of the Gospels and the Christian message. But it's a very good question. Did you have...
Yeah,
a book. It's probably, I'm glad you raised the question because it enables me to show a book to you, which would give you a way to get started in this. It's a book that we use in St. Thomas as a textbook that I and a colleague wrote called Understanding World Religions, A Roadmap for Justice and Peace. And if any of you have interest in it, I do have some flyers here which offer a 30% discount. You can take those as you go. This is the second edition, which is just out this fall. And what it does is it studies major worldviews. It studies Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, Muslim, Native American, and Marxist worldviews. And then it applies that study to Israel-Palestine as a case study where you have Jews, Christians, and Muslims living together in a context where the Zionists have treated the Palestinians the way the Europeans treated the Native Americans. And then there are chapters on religious social teaching, especially Christian, liberation theologies, active nonviolence as a better approach, and just war theory as not such a good approach. But what it's about. So anyway, that's the book. I also brought along from the library three books by George Tinker dealing with this question of the Native Americans, whether Christians deal with the Native Americans. These books are mentioned in the first book I mentioned. So when you get the first book, it would help you to know what else you get from the library to find out more about these things.
Right?
Yes. I'm just about done, so we'll move into questions here quickly.
Okay.
Did you have a question?
I had a question. I can wait.
Let me just see. Oh, yeah. What are we going to do? I said we need to repent. We need to admit. We need to admit it, we need to repent, and then we need to make amendment. So how do we make amendments? I did mention already the possibility of a Native American bill to send them to give them the education that they might need to carry on the kind of life they'd like to live. And then don't continue dispossessing. Now, what does that mean? Uranium mining, South Pacific nuclear testing. I saw a comment recently that every American nuclear test has been on Native land. From Alamogordo, New Mexico, to Bikini, the Pivot-Chickamauga, where Manitoba Power has been building dams to create electricity to sell to Minnesota and flooding out and destroying their property. Alaska, Prudhoe Bay, the oil, and then Latin American imperialism. You know, five nations in Latin America are still majority Native. That would be Mexico, Guatemala, Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador. And another disadvantage. So here's uranium mining, example of uranium mining. It's not good for the neighborhood. And here's Bikini. And Pimichikamak. Let it destroy. And oil spill off Prudhoe Bay in Alaska. So, stop doing that. What are we saying? We're talking about imperialism, right? We're talking about greed. We're talking about money. We're talking about, I want this stuff, and your stuff is in the way to me. What about you?
I just wanted, if I could just interject also,
Even today, the issue of mining and what it's doing to the Manoan, the wild race, you know, that's a today dispossessing issue. Even though it's not, some of this is unceded land, and it's going to affect the race. It's bound to affect the race, it already has. You know, so today that's just a relevant thing that's going on today.
Thank you very much for those here. I'm sure there are many other specific examples that are closer to home that I wasn't that familiar with. But the mining in the north, and particularly the way in which it affects the water quality also for everybody. Which is also an example of when we pay attention to native concerns, we may also save ourselves from disaster.
Yeah.
So take personal steps, study, understand cultural differences, make native friends, adopt a family. What about making a really close friend with a native family and then considering them as value them as you value yourself? If they have problems, it's as if they were your brother who helped to supply what they need. You know, if every native family had was each a white friend family, this would be good for both families. We'd learn from each other. Now, we'd be aware where we can begin to balance things. You know, we say, what am I doing living in this lovely house here in the suburbs or in northeast Minneapolis when my native is living, my family is living in dirt and the rest, you know? What can I do to help them get more resources? So anyway, it's just something to think about. And because I don't know, you know, once we get into this question, do we just all move off and let them have the whole land? That doesn't seem likely to happen, but to say, well, it's too bad, they're just stuck, that's not a good choice either. You know? How do we even out the resources? And the first way to even them out is to recognize each other as human beings and friends and family. All in family. All right, well, that's all I had to say. Questions? Yes?
I've got just two things that I'm trying to reconcile in my mind. Your use of psychopath in a way of explaining that the things that people did were atrocious and have no way possible that they could have done that willingly and knowing what they were doing. I think if we use the term psychopath, we want to excuse the behavior. And I have a hard time. I have a hard time with that.
Good, thank you. That's very good. Psychopaths aren't the only people who do terrible things. But psychopaths are the ones who have no feeling about it. Here's the problem. Now, this is based on a new book by a Polish writer, Alexander Lobachevsky, who wrote a book called Political Pornerology. Political Pornerology. That's from the Greek word poneros for evil. Political evil. Now, he lived through the Nazi and the communist periods in Poland. And he and a number of other psychologists and psychiatrists studied what was going on because they said our culture has been seized, it's been taken over by something weird. What is it? And this is where they began to develop this notion. And they would write to each other secretly. He doesn't even know the names of the other people. He just knows he kept getting this material and he was to be the main author. So he was coming along pretty well on the book when he got word that the secret police would be arriving in 5 minutes. So he threw the whole thing in the furnace. Then he rewrote it. Yes?
I just wanted to say there's 4 minutes left. That clock here is a little slow.
Oh, okay, thank you. So he rewrote it, and he sent the rewritten version to the Vatican by courier. Then in about 1984, he got out to the West, and he thought, well, in the West now it's free. Press here, I can get this thing published. So he checked around to see what had happened to the one he sent to the Vatican, and they said, well, it turns out it never arrived, probably. And it's likely that his courier was a plant. You know, so he said, well, he rewrote it again, but he had lost most of his data. But at least he had all the ideas, so he rewrote it.
And he thought, I need to know how can I respond. So he showed it to Zbigniew Brzezinski. Remember, was the advisor to Carter. And Zbigniew said, oh, this is wonderful. This is the greatest thing. We've got to get this published right away. And then he blocked the publication. There wasn't a publisher in the West that would touch it. So Lobachevsky was very depressed. He went back to Poland. He got it published in Polish in 1998. Well, now he was surfing the web and he ran across somebody saying things similar to what he'd been saying. So he sent him an email and said, I'm interested in my book. And she was, and she published it in Canada from a press which I think she created in order to publish her own books about flying saucers and people from other star systems invading human beings and possessing them and farming us for food. So I'm not sure I recommend her writings, but I do recommend his book. And basically he says, and this is I've read other things in psychopathology, a half of 1% of the population, so one person out of every 200, is born genetically with no capacity to feel the feelings of anyone else. It's like color blindness. You don't blame a person because you can't distinguish green from red. It's genetic. Another 5 or 6% become this way through a blow to the head, brain injury, especially at birth, or certain diseases. Mumps can do this, certain forms of polio, and certain medications. Streptomycin has sometimes had this effect. One reason we don't use it much anymore. So you get about 6% of people who are operating with no sense of what anyone else is feeling. Think Bernie Madoff. Could he have had any feeling for what he was doing?
I think it excuses people's behavior.
And that's not well.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Second, well, here, look, it was true.
It
was true. It doesn't say the behavior's over. It explains why they do it. It doesn't say it's all right.
I think it excuses it. Well, obviously not, but I guess my concern is if...
The concern is whether it's true.
If we don't take accountability, even if we do define them as psychopaths, if we don't take accountability for the people that we choose to follow or we choose to ignore their actions, I think we're obviously complicit in that. And that's something that I'm concerned when we start labeling it as a mental health concern, that we excuse their behavior without discretion of our complicit...
You're talking about our complicity, and that's the next point. And that is that there's another 12% of people who go along with these 6% who have a conscience and who say, well, but these are the people who are running things. These are the people who are getting it in. These are the people in control. If we're going to make a difference in the world, we have to operate in the world the way it really is, not as we'd like it to be. So I don't like it, but I go along with it. This is where the conscience comes in that is being misused. You know, we need to identify who these 6% are and not follow them. And not follow them, even at cost of our own lives. Not follow them. See, if it's true that there are people like this, then we need to be aware that they're there and not believe the justifications they're giving. Because they will use all this religious justification. The Pope told us so. God gave it to us. They'll use the words. But they're not feeling, they're not thinking the words. They're lying. They're just using them as God. But the 12% go along with them. Or where the real morality comes in.
Pardon? How do you know the leaders weren't part of the
12%,
not the 6%?
Well, whichever part they are, if you're not, I don't want to follow any of the 18. I want to judge the matter.
I think her point is what it seems like is you're labeling the leaders. leaders, the psychopaths, and not necessarily the 12% who are consciously doing this.
I think it just putting it into the terms of psychopaths is just really
right.
important. I don't know, it doesn't... I don't think it misses the point, though, because, I mean, we can say all of that, everybody knows that we're complicit in these situations, at least everybody in this room knows that we're complicit, or have been complicit, and so, I think it's just dangerous to try and excuse, not necessarily excuse the behavior, but attempt to address it in a means that, I mean, you're looking into current psychology where they're questioning whether empathy is developed, is whether there's a gene for empathy or if the empathy is learned. And that requires, if empathy is learned, then it requires the entire community to help other people understand empathy if they lack maybe the gene. But that's what I'm saying. This is like...
It's also possible that empathy is both learned and based on the gene. And that we want to learn it as well as we can. But some people are lacking the gene. We need to have compassion for them. And one of the things that Lobachevsky points out is he says, to be angry at the psychopath and to judge the psychopath is not helpful. Because the psychopath can't help it. But we need to recognize what's going on and not cooperate.
For me, and I can only speak for myself, but help me to understand my own reservation, the people that I'm involved with and are friends with, and my own family, is, I read this book, it's called Pedagogy of the Oppressed. And that's really the dichotomy of what's going on. You have an oppressor and an oppressed. And what's really, the oppressed is looking to free himself, and his freedom, he can also free the oppressor. And that's the same to me when you were discussing what was going on in Europe. It was the same situation. You had this hierarchical type of relationship. And so there's a lot of other things that get involved in that. The oppressed who start to feel that they cannot break free from this because they feel dependent upon the oppressor. So you have this. So to me, it's not about that, about having a psychopathic type of outlook on things. It's you're in the system. And this is what you're wanting to be part of this system. And this is what you see, you know. And so, to me, I think that is a wrong wording. I think it's a whole system of what the problem is.
Well, we raised an issue here that you might want to look into further. There are a couple of other books that help a lot. One of them is called Without Conscience. It's written by the psychiatrist who has worked out the method the psychiatrists use to determine who is a psychopath. Another is called Snakes and Suits. I have a question about it.
One thing that I am struggling with like your explanation of like the psychology of like what creates like psychopathy. Like it's not just genetics or brain injury. It's also baby nurture. Like if babies don't get a certain type of care, they're like, they learn, oh my gosh, there's no such thing as like human care. And they have that part of their brain just kind of shuts down. But so if you say that like it's just injury and genetics, then it's like every society would have 5%. But our society, like the amount of like extreme, like white society, Western society, the amount of like extreme, like psychopath, your ability to do these types of evil is so much greater. Right? And it's not, so I think that we need to be careful. There's something deeper in our system. There's something evil and deep in our Western system, in our Western frame of mind, that's creating this idea that, like, it's okay to do these things. It's not, this isn't just, like, an exception. This is our whole society, our whole way of being is based on this violence. And, like as a part of Church of All Nations, that's something that we seek to speak about and talk about regularly, not like kind of trying to excuse it or like explain it away, but just say clearly, like, we believe that, like, we want to follow Jesus, we want to confess, which also means recognizing the limitations and the extreme violence that is embedded in this culture, and not to kind of dismiss and make, like, oh, this violence was an exception, But to say, no, this is the fruit of this society, but Jesus offers another way, even if we're really, really broken, like broken people. And that's, I feel like, maybe a more full faith response than just kind of trying to dismiss just like genetics and the fact that just a few maybe genetically insufficient people were like in charge. And so that's just my concern with like your explanation.
Well, even today, you know, the idea that DNA is set is becoming like a Newton type of theology or the thought.
Yeah.
That's not true.
Yeah, it's not true.
And I find the same thing that our thinking is really impacting what's going on in us. You know, that story is in the Bible too, about the three trees in the garden. So that whole story is in there about what you think. You become what you think.
So
it really impacts what's going on.
I'm glad you added in the question about early childhood. And in effect, also the development of the brain. And that beyond the development of the brain and beyond psychopaths, there are other ways in which the culture can be infected. And I'm thinking of the works of Walter Wink, who talks about the myth of reductive violence. The West has bought into the myth of reductive violence. If there's something wrong in the world, it's someone's fault. Go figure out who it is and go kill them. And then everything will be all right. Oh, wait, there's one over here. Wait a minute. Well, okay, wait a minute. Okay, got it. Okay, everything's all right. No, wait, there's one over here. And it goes on and on. So it's Saddam Hussein, it's Hitler, it's, you know, and so on. So that's a whole other way. But let me give you just one or two quick examples of psychopathy. I was mentioning this to a couple of police officers recently, women, and they said, oh, yeah, we know all about those guys. They can pass any lie detector test. Because they have absolutely no emotional response to lying. All right, another. Somebody was being investigated by the police, and the police were having a great deal of trouble. He was accused of one of the serial murder cases. And they were saying to him, now come on, why don't you confess? Think of how much better you'll feel when you come clean, get it off your chest. And then they were at one of these conferences by Dr. Hare, who developed this method for determining a psychopath. And they realized they were going out the wrong way, so they went back to him because they were getting nowhere. They went back to him and they said, oh, okay, we have the same luck. You're just small potatoes. You don't count. I mean, look at Son of Sam. Look at all of the people he killed. And the guy said, oh, is that so? Well, let me tell you. And then he started going through a list of all the people he killed. Now, is there something weird about that?
Yeah, so what kind of society creates so many people like that? Because it's not like every culture has the same amount of psychopaths.
But every culture has psychopaths.
That shows how many more psychopaths the Western society will create compared to more communal-based societies. And I think that that's, like, we need to recognize that.
Well, that's, again, what we're doing here is we're discovering areas we should look into further.
Well, I think it's just not a helpful category because it dehumanizes these leaders. You know, and I'm with this idea that their healing is at stake, too, and that their healing is connected to my own healing.
Yes,
I think it's very dangerous to other them, particularly as a white person, to say like that they are other than me, that they are separate from me, because they're not, you know. And so to put this label of psychopath to say that their way of operating is completely foreign to my way of operating is just not helpful.
Unless it happens to be true. I have other people who are colorblind. I'm saying they're different. They see things differently. Once I understand that, then I don't say, well, they ought to be able to see the language.
But they don't exist in a vacuum. That's why I really appreciate what you're saying. Like, this person was cultivated, you know, and they were rewarded for
well, that's,
what they are. Yeah. You know?
In some cases, that may be true. But what he is claiming is, no, he is claiming that it's not in every case.
Well,
and it's a question.
Psychopathy is not a good category.
It's a question of truth. It's a question of whether there is such a thing or not.
Well, and the truth that you choose.
And if there is, then clandestinism can get us into trouble.
I don't think we're questioning the truth that there are psychopaths. I think we're questioning that you have labeled all these leaders as psychopaths.
No, I haven't labeled all these leaders as psychopaths. I'm saying some leaders are psychopaths and others follow along for a variety of reasons, all these reasons you've mentioned.
I just wonder if
Everyone, it's difficult for me to use a 21st century term about somebody who lived so long ago. To recognize that there is a biological condition like that, but then separately, we, I think, also need to recognize that there is a prevailing mindset, there is a context in which everybody is in, that all the time we are contributing to as individuals and as collective people. Mm-hmm. And so I think that maybe what you are saying is that there are people that have a very different moral code that are contributing to the creation of that mindset, and we as individuals have a responsibility to it as well as everybody together to be creating that communal code under which we want to live. So I'm feeling both tensions of I don't want to have a psychopath be excused for his behavior, but we all live under a prevailing code in which we have responsibility collectively.
Yeah, we're not using the psychopath because he's a psychopath, we're accusing him because of his behavior. We accuse anyone of that behavior, whether they're a psychopath or not. Well, we might recognize that this particular person is coming at that out of a psychopathic condition, and therefore be very careful not to get sucked in. But because the psychopath tends to be very smooth, very convincing, very charismatic, and he sucked a lot of people in. And we want to be very careful about that. But Novochevsky says, not judge them morally. We leave the moral judgment to God. Jesus himself said that. Do not judge, God will judge. But do not judge the person, but we judge the action, we judge the ideas. And if you pay attention to this, you might run into it. I mean, families often run into this. They get a psychopathic child. They simply don't know what to do with them. And they're frustrated. They try everything and nothing works. And the psychiatrist says about the psychopath, they cannot be healed by psychology. Because the psychiatrist works with them and they think to themselves, well, this is very weird. Nothing wrong with me. What's with this guy? And then they realize that this guy thinks something wrong with them. So they play along. And they look like they're getting better. The psychologist gives them a clean bill of health, and they go out, and they go keep doing the same thing or other, and they laugh at the psychiatrist. Now, think, for example, predators, sexual predators, right? One of the big problems we had in the Catholic Church was we believed the psychologist who said that this guy had been healed. And he hadn't. But he pretended. And he went out and did work for probation. And it's hurt a lot of people.
So, originally I came in here to hear about repentance, restitution, absolution, these things. And what it boils down to is understanding how this atrocity could have happened in the name of God by faith-based people. In relation to the indigenous people that we were here, we're still here. And to label some of these actions in a linear term, such as sociopath, psychopath, whatever kind of pathological disorder may be there, is, to me, it's just, and what I've heard other people retort to, is that's not taking accountability. That doesn't bring us back to absolution, repentance, yeah. And restitution. So, however, I thank you, Professor and Father, for your information. We all need to have a look at this objectively without emotionally being impacted by it. So we can get a clear view of establishing the norms of the time and of the current time as to what happened, who we are. So we can get a further look at how we can come together in a sense of reconciliation and solidarity. And I've heard a lot of things ranging from linear thoughts ranging from the new science of unified systems and the macro synergistic systems of collective consciousness, which we're all subject to. Those are the laws of the universe and of humanity that we're talking about. What we've talked about is man-made laws, imposed laws by the dominant society, and how do we subvert those ideologies into a contemporary setting. So when you look at me and you say, is he Indian? Well, I don't see the feathers. And then we look at Christianity, which is frozen in time, is where's your white robe and your beard? And, you know, those ideologies of what it is to be indigenous is frozen in a romanticized ideology of the 1800s. There's arrows and horse. Where's your horse? Where's your teeth? We are opportunists. We always have been. We didn't burn wagons to be mean, cruel, and spiteful. We needed metal. When you burn the wagon, you had the hoops, you had the barrel hoops to make tools, not weapons. And, you know, when we dance, it wasn't always to make war. We danced to let our spirit free, the drum being the beat and the rhythm of our heart in tune and sync with the beat and the rhythm of Mother Earth and all life.
Now, this is why we need to talk to each other and get to know each other. Well, Tinker points out, again, the way in which Westerners misunderstand things. A lot of New Age Westerners are thinking, let's go to the Indian sun dance and take part in it, it'll be good for us. But it says the Indian doesn't do the sun dance to be good for himself. He does it for the good of the community.
I've sun danced for 26 years, and I do so out of a deep sense of commitment to my family, to my blood, as a way to connect with who I am and resonate with this natural order of Earth. But also because I'm a Christian. Now, Christ never called himself a Christian. He was a Jew. Buddha never called himself a Buddhist. So I don't think Christianity is exclusive to the Christian faith. In other words, I feel that the Christ, which saved me, was not a male, female figure. It was a spirit. It was a Holy Spirit. And I think that to say it's exclusive to the Christian community would be wrong. Because I believe that spirit that came to the European cultures was here as well, with the indigenous people, maybe in more of a sense, because we are integrated people, we're body, mind, and soul, we're not linear people. That's why we say Mintakweas and recognize the fact that the earth has a spirit, water has a spirit. Now science is validating that. You know, there's an emotional response it has to our subjugation to it. However,
I think we're out of time, too. I appreciate all of these.
Could I recommend that we have Bob's comment, stand as the last word, and move on to the sanctuary?
Yeah, and if any of you are interested in a flyer in the book, the flyers are here. Thank you very much. I have to move on to another engagement also.